And our special guest this Thanksgiving Day night, Lloyd Pye, Everything You Know Is Wrong. Well, we're going to start by talking about ancient astronauts with Lloyd in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd Pye graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in psychology. He joined the United States Army and became an agent for military intelligence. Now, during this time, Mr. Pye began an independent study of human evolution. At the age of 30, his studies led him to conclude that humans could not possibly have evolved on Earth according to the Darwinian paradigm. By the age of 40, he could illustrate his belief by comparing skeletons in the so-called pre-human fossil record with those reported to belong to the world's four basic types of hominids. Lloyd is probably best known in alternative circles as the caretaker of the famous Starchild skull. We'll talk about that as well tonight, the complete bone cranium that looks like a hybrid between a human and some other kind of alien being. Our guest tonight. Happy Thanksgiving, Mr. Pye. How are you?
I'm doing real good, George. Thank you for having me on. It's a good night to be on.
It really is, and our pleasure. And thanks for doing this. I know a lot of people would just rather spend some time with their friends and family, but you jumped at the opportunity.
Well, I got no friends, no family. What are you talking about?
What do you mean? You have us. We're your friends and family.
Absolutely, right.
I wanted to talk for the first half hour here, Lloyd, about ancient astronauts. And tell me a little bit about what's been going on in that arena.
Well, we've got some real exciting news relative to that. We're going to be on a show this coming Monday in just a couple of days, few days, Monday night, on the National Geographic TV cable channel for those who can get it. Now, this is not a cable channel that's necessarily easy to access. A lot of people get it, but a lot of people don't. Like where I live, for example, in the panhandle of Florida, we do not get it. We do not have access to it. I think they charge a premium for it or something, and a lot of outfits won't carry it. But anyway, if you can get it, it will be an hour-long episode in the ongoing series that they have called Is It Real? And the Is It Real series looks at things like vampires and Dracula like that, and Bigfoot and werewolves, and you know they'll do an hour on each group of things like that. This hour is going to be about ancient astronauts, and so the Starchild and I were filmed as part of that show, and also on that show will be Eric von Daniken, who started the whole ancient astronauts thing back in the late 60s with his book Chariots of the Gods, and they have interviewed other people as well that will be on. So we just have to wait and see how they edited. They interviewed Zechariah Sitchin, so we just have to wait and see how it's going to be edited and how they put the show together.
You don't think it's going to be a hatchet job, though, do you?
Well, it will always be, George. These shows, I'm sure you know, and everybody that watches these kinds of shows know that you can't really get on a show like this without expecting to be hammered a certain degree. They have a pattern to them in which when they talk about any kind of material from what they call the fringe, which is what we're all interested in, they will talk about the subject there. They'll let you talk about it, and they'll let you have your say. You know, some of what you want to put out, you will get on the show, no question about it. But they always come in at the end, always, with some expert who will look at some aspect of what you've said or some aspect of what you're talking about, and they will say, this is wrong, you can't believe any of that, this is why we think this is wrong, and you have to believe us because we're the experts, and sort of dismiss the whole thing. So the deal you have to make with the devil is that you get your message into millions of homes that way around the country, but you're also going to get hammered, so I don't think there's any way to escape that.
How did the appearing on the show come about for you?
Well, the producers decided that they wanted to do a show on the ancient astronauts, and they started asking around in the community of people that would know about that, and they heard about the Starchild, and its status is probably the best, most scientifically tested relic that has ever come out of our field. So they wanted to have it on if they could, and initially I was very skeptical. the individual that had told them about the Star Child and about me was Ted Strain. I don't know if you know him. He's one of the researchers and filmographers in our field. And Ted told them about it, and I talked to Ted. I was very skeptical, but Ted said he knew the people, and he felt good about them. He had worked with them before, and that I could trust them to do the best job that they could do within the parameters that they have to work within. So I, you know, took him at his word and agreed to go ahead with it. But I also knew that we were coming up on some news in the field of genetics relative to the Star Child, and I knew that it was getting to be time that we could start pushing it out into the mainstream again, or push it out into the mainstream really at all. Since 2003, we'd been sort of sitting on it because of the DNA evidence. But we knew some things were in the wind. I knew some things were in the wind from talking to the geneticists. So it was kind of okay to have a show that was going to come on at the end part of this year. So that was another reason for going ahead to do it.
Well, you know, as long as they come into this with an open mind, I mean, that to me would be good.
I think that the National Geographic staff that did that, the shooting, came into it with a very open mind, and I think that they were genuinely impressed. I think everybody that was there during the filming and everybody that talked to them later, because they filmed other people after us, and they said that they were extremely impressed with everything to do with the Star Child, because if you really see the evidence, and they flew out to El Paso to film at the home of the owners of the skulls, so they got to hold and deal with the real ones, and the people, when you see them on the show, you will notice in some instances you'll see a Star Child skull that is all complete and whole and everything looks fine. Well, that's the stereolithographic copy that we've had made to take out in public and show when I speak about it. But you will also see, I'm sure, shots of the skulls with panels cut out of their heads. I mean, just big holes up in their heads. And those are the real ones. And those are the ones that they've had those chunks taken out to do the testing that we've had done along the way.
So, well, you don't have it.
Really, it'll get to you when you're looking at the real thing and holding the real thing and feeling the incredible difference in the weight of the two. It gets to you.
How long have you been a believer that this planet was visited by extraterrestrials? I think it goes beyond the Star Child, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it does. I started really buying into it, George, about 1990 when I first read Zechariah Sitchin's
12th Planet.
12th Planet. When I read the 12th Planet, he made such good sense, and I had already been working for years with hominoids, with Bigfoot and the Abominable Snowman and all that, and I absolutely knew that we didn't evolve on this planet, that they, the hominoids, are the native, indigenous, upright-walking primates of this planet, and we just did not evolve here. It's clear from the fossil record, and, you know, lately we've proved it through our genes, our mitochondrial DNA. But at the time, I just knew we didn't evolve here, but I had no idea where we came from. And then, so when I read Sitchin's book, I was looking for an answer that made sense to me, and his book just made sense based on what I already knew. And so I bought into it pretty much right then, and I've been with it ever since. And then the Star Child has just, you know, confirmed it at a higher level.
Do you physically have the Star Child skull with you now?
No, the owners keep both the original skulls under lock and key, and are very diligent about that, because obviously this is a very, very important relic, and as time goes by, and we're able to finally get the DNA done that we need done, the DNA testing done that we need done, I think it's going to be probably the most valuable thing in the world. So I've cautioned them many times, and they take good care of it.
Do they allow the media to videotape it, or can they travel with it?
They can't travel. It's not really safe to travel anymore. It's basically against the rules, against the law, to travel with human remains of any kind without special permissions. Now, we have done that. I have secured that from the government, and I have papers to that effect. But I don't really want to do it unless I, this is, we're talking flying. Now, you can drive them wherever you want, of course, but
right. It's
flying, it's much more difficult since 9/11. I used to fly with them without any problem. I would just open up the box and I'd say, they're movie props, not a problem, movie props, and they just let me go through, but the movie prop line wouldn't work anymore, so they keep them, and I, like I said, keep the stereolithographic copies so that whenever I do talk about it, people can see and feel the weights are the same, the look is the same, the paint jobs are the same. So you get a real good sense of it, but it's not quite the same as the real thing and knowing that you're in the presence of the real thing.
I want to do something, Lloyd, I haven't done with you since you've been on the program all these years. And I want you to tap into your incredible creative mind for a moment and position yourself as an ancient astronaut, and this is prior to the visitation of planet Earth, paint for us, if you would, some kind of scenario on how they possibly discovered our planet and what the process was for wanting to visit us, and then what you think they did once they got here.
Well, if you go along with the Sitchin story, which I do, that there is another planet in our solar system called Nibiru that swings around in a long elliptical orbit rather than the circular orbits of the regular planets, then they would have known we were here, that all the planets were here, as indeed when they told the Sumerians about it, they counted from the outside in, so that Earth was the seventh planet from the outside rather than the third planet from the inside. So they would have known it was here, and they would have known, I'm sure, what it was like. They may even have taken scouting trips here. So when it came time for them to need to replace part of their atmosphere, to repair part of their atmosphere, my understanding of it, according to the writings of Sitchin, is that they, in their rise to the high technology, the very high technology that they had developed on their planet, they had damaged the ozone layers, the atmosphere of their own planet, and they had to repair it. And ironically enough, in what we're doing to our planet, as we are damaging our atmosphere in our rise to a high technology, repeating the same mistake, we will have to, if we can do this, the best way, I understand, to repair our own atmosphere is to take extremely finely granulated flakes of gold, basically talcum powder, gold turned into talcum powder, and blow it up into the upper stratosphere so that it will just kind of float up there over on the air, on the blanket of air that surrounds the Earth. That thin layer of gold will go up there and dissipate and start, you know, having a protective effect, like those thin sheets of gold that they put in the windshields of certain cars.
Good point.
I had an old Peugeot that did that. You couldn't even tell it was there, and yet it made such a difference having that thin sheet of gold in the glass. It's the same thing. So it makes sense even here on Earth today. And yet when you read the Sumerians talking about it, it sounds kind of crazy. You'll hear a lot of skeptics just dismiss it, say, oh, yeah, they were coming for gold, like they couldn't find that anywhere else, and, you know, da-da-da-da. Well, maybe it is somewhere else out there, but it seemed to be here in real big, thick chunks down in South Africa, especially where it is to this day, where they do most of the gold mining. So they came, and they went down there, and they were taking it out everywhere they could get it easily off the Earth. And then when they ran out of that, they had to create a slave and a servant to go start digging mines and start doing really hard work to recover it. But that's, you know, that's my understanding of how and why they came. What it would have been like when they first got here, I don't know, but apparently they were well adapted enough such that they didn't need particularly bulky spacesuits or didn't need to breathe anything differently.
Right.
So apparently the atmosphere is more or less the same, or maybe they took some little pill or something that made them able to breathe the air,
yeah,
if they needed more oxygen, whatever. I don't know, but when you see the depictions of them in the drawings and things that they've left behind on the cylinder seals, you don't see them wearing very much. But in some of the statuary, you do see things that look kind of like spacesuits. So maybe they had a little bit of an adjustment problem at the first. I'm not sure.
Now, these people who came from Nibiru, though, if I recall Sitchin's work, you know, we look like them, right?
Oh, absolutely. They said we shall make the Atomu, which is us, in our own image after our own likeness, which is a line that comes out of the Sumerian tablets right down into the Old Testament word for word. So there was there's plagiarism goes a long way back. But yeah, they were indeed very much like us. I would have to say that the reason we look so different from the other primates on this planet is not because we evolved differently, but because we are really genetically engineered to be mostly, vastly more like those who created us than those of the stock from which they used to create us. In other words, when they got here and they wanted to make a slave and a servant, they wanted something that would be better adapted physically to the planet and naturally adapted to the planet than they were. So they took some of the stock, had to, of the creature that was here, and they're pretty clear about that, and their own, and they melded the two together. So I think that all this DNA work that's being done with Neanderthals is going to show that there's a little bit of them still in us, but vastly more. This other thing, the Anunnaki, is going to make up humanity than will be any kind of real primate DNA. It's there, even though we're talking about small amounts in terms of percentages.
Right.
1% between us and chimps, 0.5% between us and Neanderthals. With this new 454 life science technique where you can do it base pair by base pair and get the whole entire genome to lay it down gene by gene by gene by gene, all 25,000 of them, and you can compare that, you're going to see that 0.5% is in fact millions of base pairs, and they are going to be such that you'll see, I think that the researchers will see, that while the Neanderthals are much closer to the, you know, to the chimps, that little 0.5% or that 1% that makes us is going to be absolutely unique, and there will be no way that could have been done by evolution. And I think that, you know, they're just going to have to face up to the fact that we are genetically engineered and put here.
And one of the reasons I bring this up, Lloyd, is because we have had reports, obviously, of so many different kinds of aliens, extraterrestrials that have visited this planet.
Right.
The Greys, the Reptilians, the Nordiques, those that look like us,
right.
You know. So they're obviously coming from other planetary systems to visit
right.
us.
I think life is ubiquitous. I really do. I think that it's out there in a number of places. And if you go throughout the universe, it may be that it's absolutely everywhere you can find. And I think probably it's all going to be based around the same thing, the same kind of genes that we have, the same kind of DNA, which all life forms on this planet share. I have to think that that system was brought here, put here, introduced here, that it's, whether it was directed or undirected panspermia doesn't matter. It came here. It certainly didn't develop here. There's no time for it. You go from 4.5 billion years ago, a seething ball, a mass of boiling lava, and then suddenly around 4 billion years, you've got two forms of well-developed prokaryotic bacteria. That's put here. That's not developing here. That's put here. And so if you start out with it put here, there's no, you know, there's nothing against everything being put here along the way. So if it's everywhere and it's all based around the same basic building blocks of the DNA and the base pair system that builds the genes, that builds the DNA, then everything is going to sort of be kind of alike under the skin. You know, they say how all the races are so incredibly close that the differences are extremely superficial. I think that if you were to go into that bar scene in Star Wars, you know, with all DNA down, it would be the differences between all of them would be like 0.5%, 0.75%, 1%, like that.
Stay with us. Lloyd has a new book coming out. We're going to talk with him about that on Coast to Coast AM. And our very special guest tonight, Lloyd Pye. You know, I was looking at the calendar, and Christmas falls on a Monday. New Year's Day falls on a Monday. So keeping with our pledge to you, we will have live shows on Christmas Day and also on New Year's Day. So just make sure you circle your calendar for those as well. We are still giving out, by the way, the double classic CD interview Art Bell did years ago with the late Father Malachi Martin. And they are both classics. They're collector items. The one CD we gave out with an After Dark subscription a couple years ago, we're giving out both of them now. This one and a brand new one that we found of an old interview. When you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter, you call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505, or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Lloyd, when you were back with us in December, you were talking about writing a new book. What'd you ever do with that?
Well, I finished it in about March, the latter part of March of this year, George, and I wanted to go to a mainstream publisher with it because I think The Star Child is a serious enough subject to warrant publishing at that level if you can get it. But when I tried to do it the old way that I knew how, where you just contact editors straight out, I found out that they don't do that anymore. Pretty much at that level, you have to go through an agent. So then I had to get an agent. And one of the things that you also do nowadays that I didn't know about is you take your book to what's called a book doctor, who is generally an old retired editor who has a lot of experience. And they're not working 9-to-5 anymore, but they still keep their hand in by editing books for people to make them as good as they can be before publication. So I found out who the top science book doctor was, a man named Paul DeAngelis, and hired him to go through it. And working together, we polished it just as well as we could. And then I ended up getting through him, I got a very top-notch agent, but it's her first time to deal with a book like this from, quote, the fringe.
It's not so, like you get one of these every day.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's well, and not at the mainstream level. You know, there's a whole group of publishers out there who will publish in our field
right. Very
easily. You know, it isn't that we can't get it published, but to get it published at the highest level so that it has the best chance of reaching the most markets, it's an uphill slog the whole way. So we've notified a number of editors who we think might have some interest in this, maybe on an outside chance, and we've told them about the show on Monday night, and we've asked them to watch it and see how it makes them feel, and if they would like to know more about it at that point, to let my agent know, and we'll send them a manuscript and see what they think. So we're hoping to have something in place by the end of this year, maybe, or early part of next year, and certainly, everyone can count on this, certainly. The book will be out and in stores by the end of next year. I don't know if you're aware of this, but when you sell a book, from the time you sell it, it's approximately a year before it hits the shelves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I've got the hours out, Worker in the Light. And it took me about 2 years, Lloyd, to get that thing rolling.
So there you go. So anyway, it's going to be out by the fall of next year for sure, because no matter what, whether we get a mainstream publisher to take it or if we go with just a smaller house, one of the houses that normally publishes our kind of book, we are going to get it published. We are going to get it out. It's a good book, and I think it has a chance to penetrate the mainstream market. And I think in the course of 2007, The Star Child is going to move into mainstream awareness through a number of avenues, and it'll break out of, it's well known in the world of alternative knowledge. It's an icon even, but it's very unknown in the mainstream world. So this is going to be its year, I think, to break out, because we know now that we're going to be able to get an answer to what it actually is by the end of the decade. So we feel confident in asserting that the answer is probably going to be definitively that it's not entirely human.
What happens if this television program takes a pot shot at the Star Child. Will that affect publishing of the
book? Definitely, that's a risk, George, and it's definitely a possibility, and we all just have to watch and see what happens. But I can tell you all what basically the pattern will be. They will let us say some very good and very positive things about it. They'll let us show it and you know, tell what we think supports it. And then there will be some expert who will come on, and he'll pick some small part of it. I don't know what, but some part of it, and he'll say, you see, we can show you an example where you see this particular characteristic. And so the whole thing is just, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater and don't worry about it. They never address all of the issues that are involved. The Star Child is a very, very complex thing. It has a dozen major things wrong with it just around its, you know, just on its outer surface. That's not even talking about the fact that its bone is half as thick as it ought to be, weighs half as much, is two or three times as hard, has these fibers laced through the bone that is not seen ever in any kind of bone, any other bone in history, not human bone, not mammalian bone, not reptilian bone, not bird bone, not dinosaur bone. The fibers that are interlaced in that bone are absolutely unique, and that's apparently what gives it its durability.
We have so many new listeners all the time, Lloyd, who are probably saying, what is this Star Child? So can you give us a brief overview again, and then I want to talk a little bit more about your efforts here to get this thing published.
The Star Child skull is a real, true bone skull that was found in Mexico, buried in a mine tunnel in Mexico in the high desert country around the Copper Canyon area. And it was found in 1930. It was carbon-14 tested as about 900 years old, so it died about 900 years ago. The lady that found it, she didn't know what she had. It was, to her, like a souvenir. She kept it in a cardboard box till she died. Then she handed it to another couple, and then another couple that now have it got it. And the woman in that couple, now they've come out of the owners, you know, have been incognito for most of the years that I've been doing this, but they decided to come out of the woodwork for the National Geographic show, so I can tell you who they are. It's Ray and Melanie Young of El Paso, Texas.
Okay.
And so Melanie, it turned out, was a neonatal nurse. So when she saw that skull, she knows what deformity looks like, what it's supposed to feel like, what it's supposed to look like, and she knew that was not human deformity, just from her own experience. But, of course, knowing that and proving it are two different things, and so that's how they contacted me and asked me if I would try to, you know, go about proving it, and that's what I've been trying to do for all these years. It's a hard thing to prove. But anyway, that's it. The skull has the outward shape, I mean the outward parts rather, of a human skull. It's got a frontal bone, it's got an occipital, two parietals, two temporals, two sphenoids. It's got the parts, but the parts are all rearranged, very rearranged.
Weird.
And put together in a new pattern. It's got a neck about half as big around as our neck. It's got cheeks and lower face about half or less the size of ours. It's got eyes that are sitting down in the middle of its nose instead of up at the top of its
nose. How big are the eye sockets compared to ours?
The eye sockets are very shallow relative to ours, so the eyes that go in there, assuming they're eyes like ours, are going to be substantially different. Or either that, or they're going to bug off the face an awful lot, and we don't really think that. So the eyes
are they bigger?
Excuse me?
Are they bigger, the eye sockets?
No, the eye sockets are much smaller. They're smaller, and they have a different shape. But
okay,
the main thing, George, is they're about a little less than half as deep, and the parts, the openings, what are called the foramen openings for the optic nerve and the blood vessels and veins, nerves that serve the rest of the eye to make it move, those are squeezed down to the bottom from where they normally sit. But the thing about it is, with all of these differences, with all of these physiological differences, it's perfectly symmetrical. It's put together beautifully. It's, in fact, in many ways, it's more symmetrical than an average human being. It's very, very well put together. But it's got, it's got a much larger brain than should be in a head that size. It's got a dent down the back of the head, a little dent. You know, and you see pictures of grays. I can remember, I always see that little dent, that kind of heart-shaped dent in the top of their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, what's that about? And yet you see this skull, and boom.
It has one of the.
It has call one it, of those dents, exactly.
You call it the Star Child. How do we know it's not an alien that happens to be small?
You know, George, one of the big mistakes that I made was calling it Star Child right out of the box, because that is right away an indication that we believe that, you know, we're not balanced. In other words, as far as science goes, when I talk to the science, or when I talk to scientists or the media or anybody, when the word Star Child has to come out, right away, that just their hackles rise. That was a mistake. However, we did it because one of the other pieces that we have of it, we only have the two pieces. We have the cranium itself, and we have the upper right maxilla. That's your upper jaw, the right half of it. And we have that, and it has teeth in it and everything. Well, when we did one of the first tests we did was x-ray it, and we found that in that upper maxilla there are teeth waiting to come down. And in fact, the three front teeth were not in the holes anymore, and you could look in the holes and see that there were teeth in there ready to come down. So we just looked at each other, and of course the experts that we were dealing with at the time, the dentist at the time, said, wow, it's a child. You got teeth up in the upper part of the maxilla. That means that it's a child of about 5 or 6 years old.
Sure, who
so
hadn't had his adult teeth
yet?
Yeah.
You know, Star Child, and went with that. But later, then people began to argue about what the skull itself, the way the sutures are put together, the way the skull itself is put together, it looks older than a child. So there's debate still to this day. I'm still believing it's probably a child, but it could have been a very, very old adult that had the capacity to grow new teeth as it needed them.
Okay, so the new book, is it based on the Star Child?
Well, the new book is it's a memoir of the 7 years that I've been dealing with this, and it goes from an opening scene of how we think the Star Child came to be, where it was found, and then it goes through Ray and Melanie acquiring the skull and then moving it forward to the next level, asking people in MUFON to take a look at it and see what they thought, and then bringing me into it, and then all of the effort that I had to take it through, the different scientists that I had to take it to. And it's told as a story with a plot. You know, it isn't just a dry recitation of scientific facts. There's a lot of focus on the people, on the characters involved, because it's also a human story as well, of difficulty and struggle and ups and downs and some very low downs and some very nice ups as well. So I tried to take the lesson, I think, that the Da Vinci Code taught us all, which is that you can get people to swallow a lot of science if you wrap a real nice, compelling, moving story with it. Now, mine is not as dramatic or as fast-paced as the Da Vinci Code, but it will get you through it, and you'll feel like you've been taken on a ride by the end of it. And I think that readers will, all the pre-readers, the people who've read it up to this point, have really felt it was a good, compelling, and moving story, and I think it's going to do well.
Might be a movie.
It could be, especially if, of course, we get the result that we think we're going to get in the next couple of years. I don't see how it couldn't be not just a movie, but probably documentaries and all kinds of things. Yeah, it could be a very, very big deal.
One of the reasons why I was asking if you can travel with this skull is because I'm working on a few pilot programs for the Sci-Fi cable network, and I am pretty sure that the pilots we'll get this entire concept to a full-time air program. So we'll be doing a sci-fi show and coast-to-coast radio, obviously.
Great.
Which is my baby now.
Great.
But I'm wondering if you would be a guest on the Sci-Fi Network with us, but what do we do about the skull?
Well, you can do just exactly what the National Geographic people did. We'll get the skulls where you need them to be. We'll have to drive them. We gave them that option. We said we can take them anywhere you want. But
taping would be in Los Angeles.
It's easy enough to move them that way. We just have to know when and where. And
all right.
But yeah, we can get them to you, not a problem. Now, but keep in mind, as we told them, they're dramatically injured. There's just, you know, no way around it, and we can't get them. We can't get them fixed. We can't get them repaired until we know that the testing that we'll have to do is completely finished. But when it's over, then a company in Los Angeles, ironically enough, called Bone Clones, which specializes in the recreation of museum examples of skeletons and bones. For example, if you have a saber-toothed tiger in your museum and you want a copy of that saber-toothed tiger in another museum, you send the original to Bone Clones. They clone it. They clone it exactly. They paint it to look alike. You can't tell the difference.
What do they make it out of, plaster or something?
Yeah, well, they make it out of whatever. Yeah, it's a kind of plaster.
Something synthetic, okay.
But it's really great to watch how they operate. So Bone Clones can take the originals and patch them up, and it won't be the same. I mean, there's no way they can make it exactly the same, but they will look for display purposes in a museum, which is where obviously they would wind up. They will look close enough. It'll be really neat.
Bone Clones, is it a Hollywood type company? I mean, do they do this for movies and stuff?
No. They do, I'm sure, work for Hollywood, but mostly they work for museums.
Huh.
Recreating rare examples of things that other museums want to have an example of. You know, there's only so many great saber-toothed tigers out there. There's only so many great mastodons. There's only so, you know. And so what Bone Clones does is it clones the original so that other museums can have examples of what they want. So it's a great, whoever thought of that, but it's a great thing to do.
Oh my God. Is it expensive to do something like that?
Yeah, I tell you, if anybody listening to this, if you want to see a great catalog, of things that they offer for sale, get the Bone Clones catalog. You will just be amazed. It's so beautiful, the way the art, you know, the photography and everything. You can buy for your office a skull of virtually any animal there is. You can buy a full skeleton of virtually any animal there is. It's for sale at Bone Clones. It's amazing.
Give us general. Well, we'll go to the catalog. I love stuff.
All you have
like
to do
this.
Is just Google Bone Clones, and boom, you're right there.
I'm telling you, online people must love me because I go to, you know, catalogs like this. Sea Crane has got a great one now. I got to tell you about what he's been doing. Uh-huh. Well, I can't tell you about what he's doing because it's a secret project. But he's got it's one of those catalogs, Lloyd, that when you keep it, when you get it, you don't want to lose it. You just kind of keep. And I bet Bone Clones the same way.
Listen, I've got them stacked up in drawers. I can't bring myself to throw them away. They're just so beautiful.
One of my favorite guests on Coast to Coast, and I love them all, but one of my favorites is Michael Cremo, who talks about forbidden archaeology.
Right.
You also fit that category. You're a favorite guest. When you come on, it's exciting for me and the listeners. When we come back at the top of the hour, tell me about what your work is with the human origins and what's going on in that arena.
Great. I love Michael, too.
Are you a believer that intelligent mankind, has been around for a long time?
No, Michael does,
yeah.
We disagree on that, and we can talk about it when we come back after the break. But I feel that we're... what our genes say we are, we're recent here, and he believes that we've been here for millions of years. I don't deny that somebody was here, but it wasn't us.
That's interesting, too. We'll be back in a moment. Lloyd Pye, our guest. If you want his websites, they're linked up at coasttocoastam.com, but one is called starchildproject.com. The other is Lloyd Pye, P-Y-E.com.